fundraising efforts. You can find out more at democracynow.org. Send your resume in. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Gadars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Meadows, and Charina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is more talk radio with our host, Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is journalist Dan Forbes, author of the recent series, The Theft of a Black Baptist Church in Gentrified Portland, which was published in the Atticus Review.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Health Club's Body Positive Block Party, Thursday, October 22nd at Health Club in Portland. The Body Positive Block Party is an inaugural bash for Portland's first body positive, worker-owned, community-centered barbell gym. Again, that's the Body Positive Block Party on Thursday, October 22nd, 7 p.m. at Health Club, 1235 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of How We Got On at the Portland Playhouse, Wednesday through Sundays until October 25th. Directed by Jen Rowe, How We Got On is the story of three teenagers in the suburbs of the Midwest who dream of fame in the golden age of hip-hop in the late 80s. That's How We Got On, Wednesdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. through October 25th at the Portland Playhouse, 602 Northeast Prescott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hip-hopping is the thing that's in. It's where the Stone Cold Nitro party begins. So listen, party people with the ear to the street, the college professor and the social elite, to the fly young guys and the pretty girl. IT is going to tell you about the hip-hop world. Hip-hopping is a way of life.
Good morning. Today is October 19th, 2015. This is More Talk Radio on KBOO Community Radio, 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, 90.7 in Portland, and KBOO.fm via the World Wide Web. This is Cecil Prescott, and my co-host Celeste Carey is not with us this morning. But we will carry on in her absence. Joining me this morning is journalist Dan Forbes, who has written an insightful and revelatory article that was published in Atticus Review on the theft of a black church Black Baptist Church in gentrified Portland. Mr. Forbes is an award-winning journalist who's received awards from Columbia University, the Society of Professional Journalists, and the Drug Policy Alliance. His recent novel, The Derail the Train Wreck, was published recently, 2015, and was sparked by an NYPD assault and his successful lawsuit against Lincoln Center and the police. And Mr. Forbes is the father of 9-year-old twins, you mentioned.
I did. God help us all.
Oh, God. Well, for those of us who have raised kids and 9-year-old twins, you know, thank you for escaping their presence and joining us this morning for a little while.
Well, Cecil, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. This theft of Mount Zion Baptist is a story that I hope can grow some legs, because I think a pretty outrageous fraud and worse than fraud was perpetrated.
For those of you who might be unfamiliar with North Northeast Portland, Mount Zion Baptist Church was a community church that was located in the northeast, across from Irving Park, 9th and Fremont. It has another worshiping community is in the building now. But Mr. Forbes, in his articles, document the transformations of their community, and it is insightful. So maybe we should begin by asking you, how did you come across this story?
Well, I really came across it by happenstance. There's a I was pursuing a story, an article on the current tenant of the church, a strict Christian Bible teaching church that, remarkably enough, here in supposedly irreligious Portland, has achieved great success. It's called Door of Hope, and it's a by far predominantly white, mostly young membership church that, oddly enough, is packing him to the rafters for a serious Bible message, and that is somewhat counterintuitive. So I, as a freelancer, I find interesting things, and I was taking a look at them, and something, just trying to do a good job, said, well, let me go down to Multnomah County Recorder's office and look at the deed just to see about the history of this very interesting property. It was built in 1914 by what's known as the Volga Germans. Mm-hmm. And came across a deed in 2004 that even to my relatively untrained eye seemed very peculiar. The lines of authority for the people giving the church away in 2004, when it was still the African American Church, Mount Zion, those lines were left blank, and they were giving the church away for $0, and it just raised some red flags, and I started pulling on strings and actually spent months talking to people, being threatened with arrest by the police several times for practicing journalism, and ran into a real brick wall by the white Southern Baptists who obtained the church for free in 2004. And there was obviously something peculiar going on, and so I started banging my head against the wall.
And it's quite a revelatory story that you write about. For old-time Portlanders who might be familiar with Mount Zion Baptist Church and the late pastor, Pastor Percy Manuel, who was a force to be reckoned with in his community, and certainly a beloved pastor for those who were members of his church. So maybe we should begin by telling us a little bit about the Mount Zion Baptist Church and what were some of the things that happened to led to this transference of ownership initially.
Well, Percy Manuel passed away in early 2004. I never met the gentleman, but by all accounts was a remarkable man of God. The church was more or less dormant in 1986. the folks who had founded it had moved more or less to Gresham and transferred to a building there. And Percy, at age 70, he was a storefront preacher on Williams Avenue and had ambitions for a church and for making his mark in kingdom work, as it's known. At age 70, when most of us are thinking about putting our feet up, he engineered the purchase of this property and embarked on leading the church there as a Southern Baptist Convention African American church right here in inner Northeast Portland. And he soldiered on from 86 to his death. He was still leading his flock and serving and preaching weekly at age 87 when he passed away, and trying to make a go of it. It was never wildly successful in terms of its numbers. Most of its membership was fairly elderly as time went on. But as one of his colleagues, Pastor Donald Frazier, told me, he said Percy was inspired. He was a rich, textured preacher who, as Pastor Frazier told me, would preach to 10 people as if he was preaching to 10,000. And that was the history of what happened. And we can, I mean, that's the history of the church. Mm-hmm. And then we can get into what happened, into how it was usurped by folks from across the river.
So part of the story is also about the relationship between this small congregation and the relationship with a larger organization, which was a subset of the Southern Baptist Convention. So tell us first, the you mentioned that it was a congregation within the Southern Baptist Convention. Explain that relationship, and then we'll go further about what happened.
Well, the Southern Baptist Convention is the largest Protestant denomination in the country. It's exceeded in membership only by the Catholic Church, and it was founded back prior to the Civil War when it split from the National Baptist group back then, founded in a defense of ministers' rights to be slaveholders. And it has gone on. It's a very conservative group, the Church of Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and the major driving force behind the religious right. Speaking locally, an organ that has some 16 million members. And an organization of that size, of course, will have organizational structures. And so locally, there is an outfit called the Interstate Baptist Association, which is the Metro Portland arm that handles organizational affairs for Southern Baptist churches in the greater Portland area. That has about 70 churches as members. Who run it, and it's a fairly bare-bones affair. There's also a larger group called the Northwest Baptist Convention, which is the state of Washington, Oregon, and parts of Idaho. But for our purposes, the main group is the local group, the IBA, Interstate Baptist Association, which is the group that ended up through underhanded means gaining control of the property for $0, and then several years later selling it for a $200,000 net gain.
For those who are unfamiliar with church polity in general, it's helpful to know that the Southern Baptist Convention is a congregational-based church in which each church, each congregation is independently owned from one another. So it's not a, it's a connectional church, but not necessarily in terms of ownership. So each community is independent of one another in terms of owning, of calling and choosing their pastors, usually in terms of property. It's not normally owned by this overarching organization. But like many churches, even congregationally based churches, there's a relationship, sometimes financial, in which the larger organization helps the you know, individual congregation. So here we had a church, a black congregation of this mainly white denomination, but entered into financial relationship with the larger.
Well, they would pay dues, what are voluntary, in effect, membership dues to the IBA, and they actually received help on the loan to buy a new furnace from the larger Southern Baptist statewide group. But essentially were run independently. Their finances were independent of the IBA, and they limped along for years in what's really a very nice building. By neighborhood standards, there are many churches in what was the black neighborhood of inner northeast Portland, clustered on either side of MLK Boulevard. And by the standards of those many churches that I've seen, this was a soaring, tall, spacious building with nice tall windows right across from Irving Park. And what happened was they were having trouble making a go of it financially. And so in around 2000, Reverend Manuel, Pastor Manuel, Percy Manuel, the founder, saw what he thought was a lifeboat in the person of another SBC pastor, Troy Smith, who had a drug and alcohol treatment ministry. And so they essentially joined forces, and that lasted really only a half a year or so, and they had a falling out, and Pastor Smith was asked to leave. But oddly enough, when his group of followers, who were almost all white, left Mount Zion Baptist, a couple stayed behind, Sharon Stone and her husband Doug Stone. And Miss Stone is a very forceful personality, a crackerjack professional secretary who is well-versed in the minutiae of administration. And she gradually seized control, in effect, of Mount Zion. There were no elders to speak of, no deacons. The board of trustees usually was only one or two members. And Percy kept her under wraps while he was still alive. But when he died in 2004, within a month of his passing, Miss Stone instituted changes in the church's bylaws that eventually led to the loss of the church.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with investigative journalist Daniel Forbes about his revealing story on the theft of a Black Baptist church in gentrified Rip City. So Sharon Stone, you mentioned after Pastor Manuel died, she somehow gained control of the church. And in a way that what I think your articles say is a way that's very suspicious. So in terms of normally in terms of who has ownership and control of a property in a independent Baptist church?
Well, almost any nonprofit, including a church, has no owners. It, in effect, is owned by its membership, acting in concert. And what Ms. Stone did within starting the process within a month of Pastor Manuel's death was to change the bylaws of the church to say, prior to that, and this would be the case in almost any church, I believe, any vote to sell the property would have to be taken by the members as a whole and passed by the membership. It's a very consequential act. Ms. Stone pushed through a move saying that authority to sell the property was vested in just two trustees, which is remarkable and goes against the prior bylaws, who said that the trustees had no power to sell the church. And then in that same meeting, she pushed through a move electing four trustees that one day, but that doesn't pass muster because the church bylaws say that there's only to be one new trustee a year. And so she instituted members on the board who were not legal, And these were the folks who ended up, two of them, signing the church away for not one penny. And I should mention, the real red flag here is that the property transfer was kept secret for almost 2 years. The deed was not filed with the county by the IBA who was given the church for just short of 2 years. And that flies in the face of what any of us know about property. If you buy a property on a legitimate basis, you run, you don't walk, you run to the county clerk's office and record the deed and saying, yes, officially I own this property. But the matter was kept secret from the African American congregation for 2 years, and only when they were discussing a potential merger with a non-Southern Baptist church did the IBA swoop in and say, well, sorry, you folks don't even own this property. We do, and what's more, you're out. And they kicked the aging African American congregation out into the street and took possession of the property, changed the locks.
Yeah, literally locked them out.
That is correct.
So I just want a little bit more clarification. So after Sharon Stone was able to change the
governing structure.
Governing structure of the church, and then managed this transfer of ownership to IBA, you said that the papers were not filed with the county?
That's correct. The deed was signed in April 2004 and was only filed formally. These are documents that, there's no finagling them. They're in the county records, and it's all certainly on the up and up there as to when it was filed. It was filed 22 months later in February of 2006.
However, during that interim, IBA assumed and acted as if they had control of the property.
No, they didn't. It was kept secret from the congregation. Several members of the church said they had no knowledge until they actually showed up on a Sunday morning and found the locks changed. No, they owned the church, but they didn't actually execute the deed. And only when they felt that the church might align with another non-Southern Baptist church did they immediately execute the deed. And to backtrack a moment, it's of interest that Pastor Smith, who is now the head of the IBA and has refused to talk to me after a single initial interview once he realized, once I started finding out what had happened. Sharon Stone was his employee. She worked for him both at his private enterprise, a snowboard company that he had, and also was working with him at his drug and alcohol treatment ministry. And so, in effect, he came in and we might surmise, saw that there was, in effect, no governing structure at this property, which is, as I've said, a very nice property in Inner Northeast, a plum ripe for the plucking. And some might say left Miss Stone behind to work her way upon the church.
And she did so successfully. So let's continue this narrative. So in 2004, the congregation find themselves locked out of the property.
2006. After that 22-month gap. That's correct. And they struggled on. They tried a pastor succeeded Pastor Manuel, a remarkable man who I've certainly come to respect, named Will Warren, who was frankly had the wool pulled over his eyes back in 2004 and was a interim pastor, not yet ordained when the deed was done, and just didn't have the experience in church governance to stand up and say, wait a minute, what's going on here? By 2006, he did, but the deed had been executed, and they tried to make a go of it with the non-Southern Baptist church called Living Hope out of Vancouver, Washington, a big giant mega church. But Pastor Warren was never actually allowed to preach, and they were meeting in the convention center, and it just didn't offer a rich religious experience. And eventually the membership drifted away to other churches.
And the membership at that time was mostly elderly.
Yeah, it was never in Pastor Manuel's best days, say in the late 90s, they never had more than 60 members in this big cavernous building. And he was making $3,000-$5,000 a year. Just a real devoted man of God. And the congregation aged. But it was once Pastor Warren came in, and he was younger and dynamic, and they did gospel concerts and services in Irving Park, and things were starting to look up a bit, but they still needed some financial help.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with Daniel Forbes, a journalist who's written an expose on the theft of a Black Baptist church in gentrified Portland. If you have a question or comments, we invite you to give us a call at 503-231-8187. You mentioned, I hope you wouldn't mind just speculating a little bit in terms of why did, designs did the IBA have on that property in terms of when they gained possession of the property?
The Southern Baptist Convention, of which the IBA is the local administrative outpost, has ambitions for bringing their churches to inner cities around America. They don't have much success with it. Urban folks tend to reject, and this is a generalization because there are certainly Southern Baptist churches right here in Portland, but it's tough for them to gain a new congregation with such a conservative, patriarchal message. There's no gay weddings. Gays are not banned from attending, but they're certainly not, their lifestyle is not embraced. They're urge to celibacy if they feel they must have that orientation. Women are not allowed to preach from the pulpit, etc. So, and then there's the whole political baggage, some might refer to it as. So they don't have the physical properties in inner cities. And to have this church here African-American Southern Baptist Church are a subset. They are successful to a degree in the cities. So to have this property here available to them was certainly something they saw as an attractive prospect. And they never actually were able to get a congregation going. They tried, mm-hmm. but it didn't happen.
So here's a larger organization who wanted property, as you suggest, as a way in which to for the evangelism in which to promote and plant churches, who had not been successful. What do you think that some of the people thought when they found out about the transfer of property? I assume that many people who, after the passing of Pastor Manuel, you know, was in the process of grieving, and they wanted to maintain his legacy somehow. What did they think that they were doing? And I'm thinking about, you mentioned one trustee, Ron Granville.
The one trustee, two people signed the deed. One was Roy Granville.
Mm-hmm. Roy Granville.
Yeah. One is Roy Granville, and I'll just mention the church is a big nice building on the corner of Northeast 9th and Fremont, just a few blocks east of MLK Boulevard. And Roy Granville, who was Percy Manuel's rock, I can only surmise. I had several interviews, formal interviews with Mr. Granville, and he more or less dodged the question of why he did this. Other members of the church speculate that he did it out of loyalty to Percy's widow, Benny Manuel, who was age 85 when Percy died, the mother of his six children. And she had been living on nothing. She was literally facing eviction for failure to pay property taxes. And there was the thought that if the church was conveyed to the IBA, that compensation would be made to Benny Manuel. There were documents in the files that spatially linked compensation to Percy and or his widow with conveying the church to IBA. And oddly enough, the second person, Sharon Stone, instituted that only two trustees need sign the deed, which is remarkable, in that almost any other church is sold by a vote of the full membership. The second trustee, the one elected by Sharon Stone, was actually Benny Manuel, and I've confirmed both of those signatures on the deed. Mm-hmm. So it was really a complicated tale of Roy Granville having perhaps misguided loyalty to the pastor and his widow, who he had served for two decades in his ministry, in Pastor Manuel's ministry. And the fact that the whole thing was done in very slippery, underhanded fashion, really all the details kept secret, except from a very small group, including the folks who made it happen. We should mention, in my interview with Ms. Stone, I said, how did this church end up with IBA? This is when I was still teasing out the details. And she said that she called the secretary of the IBA, a woman named Lila O'Banion, and said, Lila, Percy, now deceased, would have wanted the church to go to IBA. Please make it happen. And she said that Lila made it happen, even though all details of church governance were under Sharon's control. So it's almost Shakespearean about the conflicting loyalties, things happening under the cloak of darkness, a new inexperienced pastor who didn't feel he could stand up on his hind feet and say, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? A congregation of aging folks who were locked out, etc. It's a sad tale.
And for those who are interested in reading this very well-written, detailed report, where may they find it?
I ended up publishing it. I suffer from overlength in my work, and this is almost a legal brief disguised as journalism. I ended up finding a literary magazine who was willing to publish a five-part almost 12,000 word story. It's chopped up into parts that make discrete sense, so don't be put off by that. But I knew of a gentleman named Dan Cafaro who runs a literary magazine called Atticus Review. Think of the name Atticus associated with Atticus Finch, the hero of To Kill a Mockingbird, and this is Atticus Review. It's online. You can just punch in any search engine, Atticus Review, and add to the search my last name, Forbes, like the magazine that I'm not associated with, and it'll pop right up.
Thank you. So one of the things that came to my mind that you addressed in your article, you know, once we read what is happening and naturally we say, well, this isn't right. Something's wrong happened here. Where was the county? Was the attorney general notified? What's happening in terms of, just because it seems as if so many things went wrong in that whole transference of property?
Well, I'm interested in that myself. It is not the county's role to police the validity of deeds. Either any party to the transaction can raise an objection, and then it becomes a legal matter. That the county informed me. The Office of State Attorney General Rosenblum did formally inform me that the conveyance broke a technical law, but I mean it's against the law. Oregon Statute 65.534 stating that any church property, the sale of that has to be notified to the Attorney General's office. That did not happen. The finagling with the trustees violated some laws and bylaws of the church. And I know for a fact that folks, lawyers in the Department of Justice, that's Attorney Rosenblum's office, the charitable activities section, are aware of what happened. And I know I sent them the report and had attempted to speak to them prior to that. A couple of phone calls to them have not been returned as to if they may or may not be doing anything. Representative Lou Frederick, who is a forceful representative for the African-American community and all of his constituents here in Portland, he's a Democratic state rep, he informed me that he formally referred the matter to both state and local law enforcement. And he told me last week that he's not heard back. Will Warren, the last sitting pastor, is seeking legal representation, and not in a criminal case, that's probably a long shot, but a civil case, and he's trying to interest a lawyer in it now. So those are, make of that what you will in terms of any legal matter.
You mentioned that you happened to come across this very intriguing story when you wanted to do a report on the current occupants of the building, Door of Hope. And I think it might be interesting to say something about once IBA controlled the property. I assume they attempted to form a congregation. They were probably unsuccessful. And how did Door Hope become tenants of the property?
Well, the IBA owned the church and looked around for a church planter, as the phrase has it. And in 2009, there's a gentleman, a pastor, who leads a very successful Southern Baptist church out in Gresham, out in far east Gresham, out in the burbs, where the Southern Baptists find more fertile soil. And he runs a very successful, large, wealthy church there called Greater Gresham Baptist Church. And he's an ambitious kingdom man himself, as Pastor Evans, and he became aware of this property that was available. And so in 2009, he bought it for $200,000, which is where the IBA netted its profit. Hmm. And he brought a pastor in there, and it just, the very conservative Southern Baptist message did not take. And the church, you know, they tried over the course of many months and people just didn't show up. So it effectively lay dormant until very early in 2014 or late 2013. Pastor Evans got a call from a dynamic non-denominational evangelical preacher, a gentleman by the name of Josh White, who is a real rock star of a pastor. And also, I can say that literally, before he found the Lord, he was the front man for successful rock bands here in the Northwest. And he had started a church you have to start small in these matters, in a yoga studio on Alberta Street. And such as his charisma and his dedication to a strict gospel message, and he's quite a dynamic speaker. They ended up expanding from there to renting a church just part-time, and achieved enough membership and enough financial heft that they have now come to Door of Hope. And they, as I believe I mentioned, have filled it to the rafters with a, as I said, went there. There were 500 people at the service I went to. Only two were of color that I saw. And they're there for some really good music and some really long sermons plucked with detailed Bible exegesis, and they're carrying on. And I'll just say one more thing in regard to them. The folks at Door of Hope, who are currently in negotiations with Keith Evans Greater Gresham Baptist Church to buy the property, are certainly aware of my reports. I've made them physically available. I've handed them sheets of paper making reference to them in emails, etc. And these are dedicated Christians, and I have not heard a peep from Door of Hope about any attempt to reach out to the dispossessed African-American congregation whose building they now occupy. Door of Hope did not was not involved in the usurpation of the church, right, but they're still in it, and it had a very irregular history as to how it ended up being available to them. And one might think that they would reach out in some act of Christian fellowship, even just holding a nice lunch, and say, folks, it's not your church anymore, but we're carrying on. We fixed it up. Just come by and break bread with us. But I have not heard any mention of that.
I'm wondering, and we'll go to our callers in a second, because very near your article, you begin writing about Door Hope and how they function. And it certainly raised my eyebrow when you talked about their negotiation about possibly joining the Southern Baptists, and in terms of how Door of Hope Church governance worked. And it's sort of like that could be a whole other story in terms of how apparently the way their church is set up, how they might, their pastors might force, would have the ability to become members of the Southern Baptist Convention in a means that counteract normal Southern Baptist governance principles in terms of the role of the congregation in making decisions.
Well, oddly enough, when I was doing my initial reporting on the story, it was at the time when Door of Hope, the leadership of Door of Hope, was considering affiliating with the Southern Baptist Convention and perhaps presenting it to their congregation as a fait accompli.
Yeah.
You talked of congregational governance of a church where the members vote on any important decision. Well, Door of Hope is not that. The pastors and the elders make decisions, and they don't even have a formal membership. The attendees, for lack of a better word, are free to endorse those decisions by their continued presence in their church or to take their faith journey elsewhere. And what I discovered was Pastor White is an ambitious man himself and is looking to expand to different buildings and have some sort of great awakening, as he puts it, in Portland. And they were going to secretly, with the thought of perhaps not informing their members, affiliate with the Southern Baptist Convention to obtain financial resources to expand. Now, this violates what is termed religious autonomy or freedom of conscience. You don't get a bunch of young Portlanders and say, oh, by the way, we're making your church a Southern Baptist church without telling them this. This was not a done deal, but it was Pastor White told me when it was happening that he did not know if he was going to inform his membership.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. I'm speaking with Dan Forbes, author of the article, The Theft of a Black Baptist Church in Gentrified Portland. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Let's go to Bob. Good morning.
Good morning. Dan Forbes, great story. Fascinating story. That's an almost unbelievable tale, although I think you've got it laid out pretty clearly. Early on, you said that the participants did some of their transfer behavior hoping to benefit the widow. Did she ever get anything out of this? Were her needs met?
No.
Do we know?
Okay. At one point, her property taxes, and this I've been in her home. She's still alive, age 96, living with relatives in a modest home. So her property taxes were not exhausting. But those are an issue, and the family had to find the resources themselves. She, I looked through two decades of church files, and with the exception of a couple hundred bucks one or two times, there was never any major compensation. She is doing okay. The family was able to pull together.
Well, hooray for that. You said that the current group was thinking of changing affiliation and that it's very hierarchical. And so how big is the management structure, the preacher and I guess it would be the board, you said is a relatively small group. How many people do you know?
It's on their website. They have two pastors, and they have what they term a board of elders. And speaking from memory, I would say there are seven or eight of these folks. So they do have, a good, strong group that runs the church. What they don't have is any real input from the attendees. And I literally use that word because they don't even have formal membership. Should anyone going there not like a decision that the board of elders and the pastors make, their only option is to vote with their feet and take their faith journey elsewhere.
Dora Hope, I'm on the website, has eight elders, all white men. And
A woman would not be an elder.
An elder. And their staff is composed of pretty large, and a couple, and some women, mostly for children, and there's a woman, women's pastor. So.
Right. It's going great guns. I mean, there are people sitting on the windowsills there. And I should say, I mentioned it briefly, the music is just fantastic. I attended some 8 or 10 times, and at a certain point felt like raising my hand and saying, can we have a little less sermon and a little more music? Because the sermons are long and challenging, and it's amazing that there are row upon row of Portlanders in their 20s, some of them taking notes on very detailed sermons about the Old and the New Testament.
Okay, well, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay, we're speaking with Dan Forbes, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I just had a couple of really quick things. First, you mentioned a detail early on about being threatened with arrest by a policeman for doing journalism. That just sort of made me curious.
No, as I recall, I mangled my sentence there. I was threatened by Troy Smith with him calling the police for the practice of journalism. And at one point, I had a brief initial interview with the IBA, and I learned more facts and sought to talk to the folks at the IBA about that, and was sitting in their parking lot. I got messed up with traffic and arrived too late, and was just sort of sitting in their parking lot. It's a church in Southwest, bemoaning my failure to get there on time, and a guy saw me and said, "Who are you?" And I identified myself. He knew my name because I'd been making inquiries, and he said, "Get out of here, and if you come back, we'll call the police." But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I've dealt with a lot worse when I tangled with the White House over drug policy, but that's a story for another day.
Well, the other quick thing was, I mean, I don't imagine necessarily know anything about this, but it kind of sort of makes you wonder if this sort of thing goes on more widely.
Well, Cecil can perhaps speak to this as well, but the stalking of aging churches with weak governance sitting on inherently valuable real estate is by no means unheard of. It happens, you know, in rural South Carolina and inner Northeast Portland and a lot of places in between. It's not common, but folks have nodded knowingly that, yes, this does happen.
Okay, well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And as you noted briefly in your article, certainly in inner North Northeast Portland, where property is very prime, churches do not pay taxes. So that I think it would be in the interest of city, maybe, to encourage the transference of property to property owners where taxes would be paid.
Well, one reason the physical property was of such interest is an executive at the IBA, when they were still talking to me, told me that Portland flat out is not issuing new permits for churches in any sort of desirable property, that mm-hmm. there's no taxes. And, you know, you hear of churches becoming McMenamins. I believe mm-hmm. there's one on Killingsworth right by the library there, just east of Vancouver, that was
a funeral home.
Was it a funeral home?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm mistaken.
With a crematory in it, so.
I'm mistaken there, but I also know that there was a African-American church just about three blocks from Door of Hope / Mount Zion that was just recently demolished, mm-hmm. And they're putting up some remarkably unattractive townhomes mm-hmm. there as we speak.
Exactly. I want, before we leave, I want you to say something about your book, Derail This Train Wreck. What is it about, and how many people get it?
Well, Cecil, I shrink from speaking of my novel, but I'll overcome my natural resistance to doing so. I've written a novel about our no longer nascent police state that melds farce with noir. It's called Derail This Train Wreck. You can find it. It was published by an outfit called Fomite Press, Fomite Press, which has about 70 titles they've put out. And you can find it on their website under my name. And think of a ill-stitched Dick Cheney of sorts has burrowed his way to the top. Repression is rampant. The police state hammer is falling on both tall and short alike, and most people are keeping their heads down. My hero, of course, is too foolish to do that, and he seeks to draw a very small line in the sand about one aspect of the quotidian repression, and things, of course, explode wildly beyond his control, and he has to scramble to keep body and soul together. And in a rollicking, rather funny way, generous reviewers, if I may be so bold, have compared it stylistically to J.D. Salinger and Saul Bellow and Kingsley Amis. So if you wish, Fomite Press, derail this train wreck. It's hard for me even to say. It's a title deliberately tied in knots. I think it's pretty cool.
Excellent. Do we have another caller? Oh, good morning, Francis. Sorry for keeping you on hold.
It's no problem. I wasn't on hold that long, and I appreciate your guest effort. And
if he has the time ever, that's my old neighborhood. That's where I raised my children, Sabre neighborhood, and I watched it gentrify. I was also forced out of my home when the owner of my home I rented from, she suddenly died, and her property was immediately sold out from under me. But what I would appreciate is if someone, it's not surprising to me what happened to the church there, if someone would bother to research a lot of property transfers in that neighborhood, not just the church, but say the commercial little block up the street on between 13th and 14th, just study the way the property was transferred there and how zoning changes happened after new ownership occurred and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It's very nefarious things that happened in our neighborhood and how homes were acquired and the chronic nuisance ordinances. If somebody had the time to research a lot of property transfers in that neighborhood, they would be amazed.
Very good.
And hopefully at some point the full story will be told, because I'm sure the records are there somewhere in the county, but somebody just has to have the time to research them.
Well, if I may comment on what you say, you're absolutely correct, and the demolition of old homes is rampant around there.
Right. And also the way the people were forced out of their homes.
That's correct.
Nefarious.
I interviewed some dozen members of Mount Zion, the folks forced out of their church, and when they were going to the church in 2002, 3, and 4, they all lived within a 5-minute car ride of the church, and now they're dispersed far and wide to Happy Valley.
Exactly.
And far off Beaverton, and very few of them live anywhere in inner Northeast any longer.
So if somebody steps back and looks at the big picture, that church is just part of a huge process, and I appreciate your efforts in researching this, and hopefully there'll be more done. Thank you.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you for this investigation. You wanted us...
Well, no, I just was going to thank Frances for her call. We believe it or not, it's such as the nature of radio, left out a lot of the granular detail as to how this bamboozlement came down. And I would just encourage folks, if you have any interest, Atticus Review, the same name as Atticus Finch, and just pump in my name, Forbes, to the Atticus Review website. They were real clever in what they did, but they got caught.
And, you know, it is a fascinating article, and there's much more that we were unable to talk about this morning, so I would encourage people to get this article. I mean, just in terms of even how the church continues to you know, pay for fuel and heating, and how their donation to the convention was raised, and it's lots.
Oh yeah, even after they secretly took the building, they then plundered the corpse, as I say, by raising the fees to the Baptist Association from $500-$600 a year to $5,600. And that was almost what they were paying their new pastor, Will Warren. This was a $25 million organization pitted against a church with a total budget under $30,000. And in this case, Goliath beat David.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for joining us this morning. His article, is the title. It's a long title.
I call it the Church Theft article in Atticus Review. It's gentrification, et cetera.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott. We will see you at another time.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
most of my life in prison, chasing a dream called justice.
Measure 11, Oregon's One Strike You're Out law, was passed by Oregonians in 1994. It mandates long-term prison sentences and tries 15-year-olds as adults. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on October 19th to hear criminal defense attorney Jesse William Barton discuss ideas for reforming Measure 11, including invalidating its companion Measure 10. That's Prison Pipeline, October 19th at 6:30 p.m.
Won't somebody please set me free?
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming up on 9 o'clock. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Revolution Hall, presenting Southern blues rocker and ZZ Top guitarist Billy Gibbons and the BFG's Perfecto Mundo Tour. Billy Gibbons performs Friday, December 11th, and tickets and information for this 21 and over performance are available at revolutionhallpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO FM Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Jan Hawken, your host for today, with Joe Clement, who is engineering. The Old Mole brings you news, reviews, and commentary grounded in the struggles of everyday people and guided by the idea that a better world is possible and that collective action is necessary to bring it about. Although we are awash now in campaign promises, leaders offering to take us to their visions of a promised land, progressive social change depends on our own organized efforts. On the show today, we take up critical